Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, Syrian warplanes bomb targets near Damascus. The Turkish government in talks with a Kurdish rebel chief. Thousands of Palestinians jam into main squares of Gaza City. And India's judicial system in light of a fast-track rape-murder trial.
India has one-fifth the number of judges that it ought to have.
It's all ahead. Opposition activists say Syrian warplanes bombed targets near Damascus today. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says government shelling is underway in areas including Douma, a rebel stronghold. Civil war between rebels and the Assad government has gripped Syria since evolving from peaceful anti-government protests in March 2011. The United Nations estimates 60,000 people have died in the conflict, a figure that surpasses opposition estimates by about a third. The UN Secretary General spokesman, Martin Nasirsky, talked about the latest report.
The analysis carried out by data specialists on behalf of the United Nations has led to the compilation of a list of 59,648 individuals reported killed between the 15th of March 2011 and the 30th of November 2012. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, said that as there's been no let-up in the conflict since the end of November, we can assume that more than 60,000 people have been killed by the beginning of this year, 2013. She said that the number of casualties is much higher than expected. Ms. Pillay said that the analysis provides a very useful basis upon which future investigations can be built to enhance accountability and provide justice and reparations to victims' families. She also called for serious preparations to restore law and order when the conflict comes to a halt. The data, the numbers, came from seven different sources, the Violations Documentation Center, the Syrian Network for Human Rights, the Syrian Revolution General Council, the Syrian Shuhada website, the March 15th group, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, and the government of Syria. So there was obviously overlap in those figures, which is why the data analysis was done, so that you can, to the extent possible, remove duplication in those figures.
The UN Refugee Agency says about 84,000 people fled Syria in December alone, bringing the total number of refugees to about 500,000. Many more are internally displaced. Meanwhile, the parents of an American journalist who has been missing in Syria for more than a month have appealed to his captors for compassion and any information about their son's well-being. John Foley said his 39-year-old son was kidnapped in northwest Syria by unknown gunmen on November 22nd.
As you might imagine, we don't want to negatively influence the ongoing search for Jim. And so we cannot comment in detail except to say that we're gravely concerned about Jimmy's health and welfare, his safety. We miss him terribly. He's in our thoughts and our prayers every day. And we're committed to do everything within our ability to secure his safe release, and this is our only priority. Jim is an objective reporter who has been working as a freelance journalist in Syria for over a year. He's passionate about giving life to stories of people within conflict areas. We are grateful to the Syrian people and to all those others who are helping us work to release Jim and other captives. As Jim's father, I appeal to the people who have Jim to let us know where he is and to help us secure his release and to give us some information in terms of his welfare, his health. We'd like them to contact us so that we can begin to work with him in terms of helping moving forward in Jim's release.
The reporter has worked in a number of conflict zones in the region, including Syria, Libya, and Iraq. 28 journalists are known to have been killed in Syria in 2012. The Turkish government is in talks with the imprisoned Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan. However, questions remain as to whether the government is ready to make necessary reforms to persuade rebels to give up their fight when Kurdish nationalism across the region is increasing. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
A senior advisor to Turkey's prime minister, Yalcin Akdoğan, confirmed Turkish intelligence officers have started talks with the imprisoned leader of the Kurdish group, the PKK.
Silahların bırakılmasına dönük netice alacak Her türlü çalışma elbette bizim için önemli.
The goal is the disarmament of the PKK, Akdoğan said. You can't win through armed struggle. You have to use other tactics. Negotiation is one of them. The Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, has been fighting the Turkish state since 1984, a conflict that has claimed nearly 40,000 lives. Akdoğan expressed hope that the rebels could give up their fight as early as spring, and his leaders agreed to go into exile. But international relations expert Soli Özel at Kadahas University questions whether Turkey's government is prepared to give what is necessary to achieve such a goal.
This is all geared towards making sure that the PKK drops the guns, which is fine. But to the extent that we also have a political problem vis-a-vis Kurds of Turkey, which is a problem of citizenship primarily, we don't know where the government wishes to take the country. And given the fact that we are all now locked on to presidential election of 2014, I really don't see the government moving in a direction that might alienate some of the conservative and nationalist constituencies on which it depends.
Observers warn the PKK is far from ready to give up fighting. In the last year, violence has returned to the levels of the 1990s, the height of the conflict. The rebels are fighting for autonomy and greater cultural rights. But with presidential elections not due for another year, Sinan Ülgen, head of the Istanbul-based research institute İDAM, believes there is a window of opportunity for the government to make concessions.
It's going to be a long-drawn and a gradual process. I think there are two critical issues here. Is indeed one, you know, how much the government will be prepared to offer. That certainly would be what is currently being negotiated. But the second one is really the issue of trust. And here, I think it's a question of both the government trusting the parties that it's negotiating with, but also the PKK members trusting the Turkish government that it will actually deliver.
Öcalan has been cut off from his supporters for more than a decade while being imprisoned on the island of İmralı. Questions remain as to what influence he has over the PKK. Political observers point out his credentials were enhanced last year when the Turkish government turned to him to help end a protracted hunger strike by imprisoned Kurdish rebels. International relations expert Özel says this may be the best opportunity for the government to show it's moving in the Kurds' direction.
The Kurdish nationalist movement regionally is making its appearance on the world stage with a quasi-independent Kurdistan in Iraq and autonomously run Kurdish regions of Syria in the north, and the Turkish Kurds are being left behind in all those developments.
The last talks between Öcalan and the government broke down 2 years ago. The collapse in those talks saw a marked increase in fighting, which continues today. Observers say with Turkey facing a presidential and general election in 2014 and 2015, talks with the Kurds could present the best opportunity for success for many years to come. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
Thousands of Palestinians jammed into main squares of Gaza City for the first rally marking the founding of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah political group since 2007. Fatah supporters chanted and waved yellow and black flags today as they marked the party's 48th anniversary. The group was founded by the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat in 1965. It is the first rally for Fatah in Gaza since the rival Hamas group took control of the region in 2007. Tensions have begun to ease between the Fatah and Hamas factions. Hamas recently held its first rallies in the West Bank. In November, the two groups pledged to strengthen relations after the UN General Assembly voted to recognize Palestine as a non-member observer state. India has set up a so-called fast-track court to try the men accused of the gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old girl in New Delhi, whose case has prompted nationwide protests and public demands for swifter justice for sexual assault victims. The fast-track court is one of five being set up in New Delhi, known ominously by some as the rape capital of India. The courts will hear cases of sexual assault and other crimes against women in an effort to bypass India's overwhelmed regular court system, where cases can often take many years to be resolved. VOA reporter William Gallo spoke about the newly established courts with Colin Consalves, a senior advocate of the Supreme Court of India and the director of the New Delhi-based Human Rights Law Network.
Just how backlogged and overburdened is the Indian judicial system?
India has roughly 12 judges per million population as compared to America, which has 50 or 55 judges per million population. And it is generally estimated that for large populous developing countries, you need roughly 60 judges per million population, which means that India has one-fifth the number of judges that it ought to have. So if you have one-fifth the number of judges, right, you realize that a case that is going to take 1 year will take 5 years. Because a judge has on his board, the court schedule every day, five times the number of cases that it ought to have. So the judge is sort of adjourning four-fifths of all the cases and dealing only with one-fifth, right? That's the situation in India.
And how was the government dealing with the problem before the latest case that prompted a public outcry?
Instead of tackling this issue, government said that it would create certain fast-track courts to deal with this problem of arrears. This was started sometime in 2007, and even though it did not address the issue fundamentally, it was a piecemeal approach. It was an ad hoc, knee-jerk reaction to arrears. It was welcomed because at least it meant the appointment of judges. By 2010, 2011, government backtracked and said that it's too expensive. We don't want to spend all this money on fast-track courts and began withdrawing funding. And the fast-track courts were wound up in many states in this country. Overall, the central government and the state governments have decided to disband the fast-track courts because it is too expensive.
What's the performance of these fast-track courts been up until this point, would you say?
Persons who have worked in the fast-track courts are generally very upset by the declining standards of the fast-track courts, and they've termed it as fast-track injustice. These fast-track courts are given targets, unrealistic targets of cases to finish, and they have been told that they ought not to get involved in too much technicality and so on. And broadly, if they get a feel that a person is guilty, you know, declare him guilty. If he's innocent, declare him innocent. Now, that's not how the criminal justice system works. The criminal justice system is a very technical system. It requires care and attention. It's not, you know, decisions are not made on the basis of hunches and guesswork, which is what the fast-track courts turned out to be. Very heavy workload. Judges unable to keep up with this workload. Judges, you know, cutting down on evidence. Not allowing full cross-examination, proceeding in the absence of lawyers in many cases. It was, in many respects, not very satisfactory system.
Any indication that the latest attempt will be any better than the previous attempts at establishing fast-track courts?
I don't think. Because, you see, the approach is not overall. The approach is not fundamental. You see, the approach is only in Delhi. In Delhi, you know, immediately we go and start some fast-track courts and make a great show of things. It's part of our Indian government reaction to crises by offering palliatives, you know, not really addressing the issue, but by hoping the movement will die down by this pretense that we are doing something about it. It's nothing else but that.
In your estimation, what is the way to fix this in a more comprehensive manner?
It's very simple. The Chief Justice in his Law Day speech has sort of set out what budget is required. You know, we need the money. It's simple. It's a democratic country. You have so many laws. You have to implement those laws. So we have to increase the number of judges five times and make the courts for them to function, give them staff and so on, and spend money on the judiciary. The arrears will be wiped out overnight. With all my experience as a lawyer, I've practiced as 25 years and 12 years in the Supreme Court, that if you have even three times the number of judges that we have today, the arrears will come down dramatically. Not only, actually, there's one more thing. Fast-track courts for rape cases, right?
Now, what about fast-track courts for domestic violence cases? What about fast-track courts for matrimonial cases where women are in divorce proceedings and maintenance and custody proceedings for their children for 10 years? What about tribal displacement cases? What about slum demolition cases? What about labor cases? You understand, there are whole sections of courts and cases regarding poor people. Now, you make the pretense of fast-tracking one, taking away the resources from the system generally, what will happen to all the other cases of all the other poor people in society? So when the Prime Minister said, "I feel your pain," I don't believe he actually felt that pain. And we don't want him to feel our pain. We want him to empty his pockets. That would be the best gesture.
Colin Gonsalves, a senior advocate of the Supreme Court of India and the director of the New Delhi-based Human Rights Law Network. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.